Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we look at Kentucky's bid for the sipping whiskey market. Some feel Kentucky's small batch and single barrel bourbons are right up there with the brandies and cognacs of the world. Our guest is Frederick Booker Noe III, one of the pioneers in this new take on American whiskey. Steve Beaumont, our beer guy, tells us all about one of the darlings of the microbrews, India Pale Ale. Anya Von Bremsen, food writer for Travel and Leisure magazine, takes us to what she claims is the most exciting place to eat on the planet. Then Diane Ackerman, the poet and naturalist, muses out loud about bread. And in the second half of the show, as we do every week, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, you know, I haven't yet seen a book called Fine Cuisine of America's Bowling Alleys. But if there is such a book, we know the place that should be featured in it. It's the Blanco Bowling Club Cafe in Blanco, Texas.
What do you eat in a bowling alley?
Well, three meals a day, for one thing. The bowling alley is open only at night. So during the day, you can come in the morning for fabulous, freshly baked cinnamon buns, which are a real passion down in this part of Texas. At lunch, you come in for a good square meal or Tex-Mex food. At dinner, you have meat and potatoes. And no matter what meal you eat, and even if it's breakfast, you have to have a piece of pie because this place has some of the best meringue pies we have seen anywhere in Texas, a state where pie is taken very seriously.
And Lynn, I have to just paint a picture of small town America for you, a la Blanco, Texas.
Blanco or Blanco?
Well, I say Blanco.
Excuse
because,
me.
Because, you know, Blanco, Texas is a classic small town in that there's, you know, this beautiful 1886 vintage courthouse and little shops all around the town square. And right on that town square is the Blanco Bowling Club Cafe. In the back of the cafe is where the bowling alleys are. And up front where you sit is where you eat. So you're not like, you know, sort of sitting right directly in the line of crashing bowling pins.
And the thing about this place is this is the town cafe. I mean, this is where locals gather for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's not just a place where you bowl and happen to have a meal. It's where you go for a meal. And if you happen to want to go bowling later, that's what you'll do. So, I mean, it really is a place. It's a destination diner in Blanco, Texas.
And in Blanco, Texas, since Blanco means white, the most pristine and beautiful object of food in this Blanco Bowling Club Cafe is the coconut pie, which is ivory white, has about a 4-inch hand-whipped meringue baked on the top of it, and wonderful filling, not something that just gets poured out of a container. It's really homemade custard coconut pie. And beautiful ivory white, like a bride's dress.
Well, since I'm being the contrarian today, I have to say that the pie that I like best, and all the pies there are spectacular, is the fudge pie, which is really dark, super chocolatey, and has an equally tall white meringue.
I just realized something. Every single pie has meringue on it. Is this a Texas thing?
It's not. I think meringue is not necessarily a Blanco thing or Blanco thing or Texas thing. But the fact is that Texans do seem to appreciate meringue pies more than the rest of us.
I think the lore of the meringue is that it's so incredibly humid and hot in most of Texas that to make a good meringue in high humidity is a feat in itself.
Well, that makes sense. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
I like pie. I hope to die. Just get a load of this. When you get high, doggone the pie, baby, come on and knock me a kiss.
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs.
every week you can hear them here on the Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Anya von Bremsen is a concert pianist turned food writer. She's written cookbooks like her award winner on Russian food called Please to the Table. But Anya has wanderlust, and that led to her becoming a contributing editor for Travel and Leisure magazine, reporting on the world's food scenes. Anya, welcome back.
Good to be here, Lynn.
Okay, so where have you been recently?
Well, I once again returned to a place that completely surprised me. It's a region of Spain called Asturias, and I don't think a lot of Americans are familiar with it. It's on Spain's Atlantic coast, sort of wedged between Galicia to the west and Cantabria and the Basque Country. And it's a fabulously pretty region that includes some of the most rugged mountains in Europe called Picos de Europa, and a sort of very moody, almost Scotland-like coast. So you really feel like you're in the Scottish Highlands or somewhere in the deep of Maine, you know, it's a kind of misty. It's nothing that we associate with Spain. There's no flamenco, no tapas, no sherry. It's real sort of this atmospheric, misty, moody north. Mm. And what I've discovered there completely blew me away, because there's this whole food revolution going on, you know, and in the middle of nowhere. For instance, I had lunch at a fishing village, which is not even on a map. Population 80, only fishermen, just kind of tatty white houses. You know, it almost felt Scandinavian. And I ate a lunch there that I swear if a critic from Paris or New York would eat this food, they would just flip. I mean, there's nothing like it that I've ever eaten anywhere, just for its conceptual brilliance, the freshness of the produce. And it's this guy called Paco Rom, the owner, and I don't know what he's doing there. No one ever comes there. And he's just cooking this world-class, amazing food. And he's not the only one. It's happening all over this incredible region.
Give me an example. What did you eat at that lunch?
Well, for instance, I had a green tea and chocolate mousse that was just out of that world. Or, you know, first came, you know, six or seven different appetizers, all this layered, savory mousses, granitas, and sorbets, you know, with each dish having, you know, three or four different elements. Or he would just present, you know, the freshest, loveliest piece of fish, you know, that he just got in the morning from the fisherman, you know, just dusted with sea salt, with a swirl of olive oil, and just kind of a little ring of bitter greens. That is just perfect.
What is the traditional food like in this part of Spain?
The traditional food is essentially a million variations on beans, smoked sausages, cabbage. It's real sort of winter mountain food. You know, imagine, you know, the national dish is called fabada, which is like the Asturian answer to cassoulet. And in terms of drink, there's a very interesting tradition. They drink cider.
Huh.
But it's not the sophisticated Normandy apple cider that we know. It's this really diabolic sort of fizzy sour brew that you pour from an arm, you know, you pour it from great heights into special wide mouth glasses so that it aerates. And you drink just an inch of it, and then you pour it again. And what you don't drink, you pour on a sawdust-covered floor. So these taverns called Chigres are just completely medieval, you know. And, you know, an average Asturian male, you know, drinks 10 liters of this stuff. You know, they live in those Chigres, you know. And you get out of there and your shoes are smelling of alcohol. And, you know, they eat mountain sausages like wild boar chorizo. And it's a great cheese-making culture as well. You know, the famous blue cheese called Cabrales, That's from Asturias.
So, Anya, what was your most exciting meal?
My most exciting meal, not just in Spain, but probably one of my most exciting meals in the world, was at this place called Corral de Indiano. And it is a small hamlet called Arriondas, which has another incredible one Michelin star restaurant. So you have this tiny town in the middle of nowhere at the foot of the mountains that has two outstanding restaurants. But this place, Corral de Indiano, intellectually and technically, the guy just blew me away. For instance, he does a foie gras dish in which the foie gras is not the star element, you know, served in some kind of fancy frou-frou sauce, but it comes in this hyper-reduced broth of chickpeas, and it's coated with coarse cornmeal, which is the chef's allusion to the local chicken feed, and it comes accompanied by a chicken lollipop that's so technically complex it takes 4 days to make, and essentially it's just a very thin layer of chicken skin that explodes with molten foie gras inside. So it looks like this hyper-rustic traditional dish, and then you start looking at it, and it's just technically phenomenal. It's mind-boggling.
Well, I know where I'm going on my next holiday. Anya, thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen is a contributing editor for Travel and Leisure magazine and is author of the award-winning book on Russian food, Pleased to the Table. Coming up, a new take on bourbon, a look at India pale ales, which most people in India have never tasted, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. There's some new action in the bourbon world these days. It's called small batch and single barrel bourbons. Experts are practically saying prayers over them. Some say they're right up there with the great brandies and single malt scotches. Now, one main difference with bourbon is it's pure Americana. It's made from corn, mainly in Kentucky. Well, to learn more about these bourbons, we've invited a producer to join us. He's Frederick Booker Noe III. His family first made bourbon in Kentucky in the 1790s. His grandfather was Jim Beam. Frederick, welcome.
Hi, man.
You know, I've got this image, and it may be a romantic one, that bourbon's always been a family business. I have this image that there's just were a lot of families out in the countryside who had stills and started making bourbon, and in some cases they got to be larger businesses. But is this true?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I'm actually the seventh generation Beam family member to be involved in, you know, in the bourbon production. But I've got cousins that are involved at the Heaven Hill Distillery. Parker Beam is a cousin of ours. So, I mean, you know, it is the family. I mean, the Beam family has touched a lot of distilleries here in Kentucky. You know, it's a... You know, it's kind of in our blood, you know. The people here, we like to do it. And once you're kind of born into it, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else but what I'm doing today.
And it started because there was local corn and people wanted
yes,
to
ma'am.
Have some spirit.
That's what it all, the story is that we had, Kentucky was such a great place to grow corn, and distillers moved here from up in Pennsylvania, and they had this abundance of corn, so they started making the bourbon from the corn that they grew here locally. And that's why all the bourbon is made mostly right here in Kentucky.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about small batch bourbons. What exactly is a small batch bourbon?
Well, small batch bourbons are bourbons that we don't mass produce. You know, we put a little more tender, loving care into them when we are distilling them. You know, we give them a little extra more aging.
Mm-hmm.
The packaging is not, you know, it's done by hand. You know, it's just what we've put a little more care and time into.
So the average bourbon is aged how long?
4 years is what our Jim Beam white label is. It's 4 years old.
And so a small batch bourbon would be aged how much longer?
The minimum that the youngest bourbon we have is Baker's, and it's aged 7 years. You know, up to Knob Creek, which is aged 9 years. You know, my dad's bourbon, the Booker's bourbon, it's aged until he says it's right. I take the samples home to my dad, and he tastes them, and we sniff them, and we look at them. You know, the color and everything has to be perfect because it has his name on it, and he wants it to be the best bourbon you can possibly get.
All right, but now the idea of small batch, are these bourbons in barrels? Are they literally in smaller containers?
No, ma'am. They're all in 53-gallon barrels, but when we distill them, we don't run several days. We'll just do a little bit at a time. And we put them away and we dump only a couple hundred barrels, as opposed to like when we do Jim Beam or some of our other products, we may dump 700 or 800 barrels. And we, you know, we store them in special places in the rack houses to give them, you know, the special flavors we're looking for. And we just do it, you know, it's just a slower process.
Now, are these barrels like wine barrels? I mean, are they made out of oak? What are they made out of?
They're white oak. Yeah, the barrels that we use to store the bourbon are charred inside. And the significance of the charring is it brings the natural sugars in the wood to the charred area. The wood is trying to heal itself, and it sets up a caramelized layer right where this char ends and the wood begins. And over the change of seasons here in Kentucky, we have a natural expansion and contraction that goes on inside that barrel. It's forcing the bourbon in and out of the wood. As it's passing through that caramelized layer, we're picking up all our color and a lot of the flavors that you get in the bourbon.
Huh.
The longer it stays in this barrel, the more of the sugars you get out of the wood.
So how many kinds of small batch bourbon do you guys do?
We actually have four bourbons that are in our small batch bourbon collection. And we start with Basil Hayden, which it's a bourbon. It's named for a distiller that came to Kentucky from Maryland, who, if you're familiar with Old Granddad bourbon, it's the man on the Old Granddad label. You know, and we make it with twice as much rye, which gives it a little spicier, you know, flavor. You know, people who like Canadian whiskeys,
mm-hmm.
they tend to appreciate the flavor of the Basil Hayden. You know, and then we move on to our next bourbon we call Knob Creek, and it's named for a little place here in Kentucky where Abraham Lincoln grew up as a little boy. It's a 9-year-old, 100-proof bourbon. You know, it's aged the longest. You know, and it gets more of the flavor from the barrel. Get more of the sweetness that comes from that barrel. You know, in the Knob Creek, it stands up real well to the vermouth, say, in a Manhattan cocktail. And then the next bourbon that we in our collection is Baker's Bourbon. It's named for Baker Beam, who's a cousin of mine who recently retired from the plant. Baker worked on this bourbon. It's 7 years old, 107 proof. You know, in the flavor of the Baker's, people who like cognacs tend to appreciate the flavor of the Baker's Bourbon.
Uh-huh.
And the last, but most certainly not least, is my dad's bourbon, Booker's Bourbon. It's the only bourbon in the world that's bottled uncut straight from the barrel. I mean, we don't filter it in any way. We let the consumer reduce it to the proof that they like to drink it. And the proof changes with each batch depending on when my dad picks the barrels. You know, it's the strength depends on, you know, where the barrels are stored and just what my dad likes that particular day that we pick it out.
Now, when you say proof, you mean the percentage of alcohol, right?
That's correct. In... Yes, ma'am.
Now, that affects the taste of the bourbon?
Oh, yes, ma'am. You'll see differences, you know, like in the Booker's, it's a little higher proof, you know, and it's got a little more robust flavor. You know, it's kind of the way bourbon was 100 years ago. You know, I always say, you know, this is the way bourbon used to be, the way it was meant to be.
You know, I'm curious, do you ever drink single malt scotches, and is there any similarity between them and these bourbons?
I drink a little single malt scotch, a little with our scotch blender, Richard Patterson, from over in Scotland. I see a little similarities and, you know, some of the flavors, like between the Knob Creek and some of his, you know, I think maybe the extra aging.
Mm-hmm.
There's some similarities there, but, you know, there's big differences in the flavor. I think the bourbon is a lot sweeter. you know, than the Scotch, you know, in my opinion, because it's a corn-based product. You know, we're making our bourbon out of corn, mm-hmm. which is a sweet grain. That gives it a sweeter flavor.
So how do you like to drink these bourbons?
I like to sip them most of the time with maybe just a cube or two of ice and a little water, just depending on the, you know, the mood. You know, if you're in a, if you've had a bad day, you can put a little less water and a little more bourbon. And, you know, and it tends to make the day go, you know, get by a little better. You know, you can kind of forget about some of your problems sitting on the back porch, just kind of sipping and savoring a little small batch bourbon.
I could do that. This sounds really good. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Frederick Booker Noe III is Master Distiller Emeritus at Jim Beam. Stephen Beaumont has been tracking our changing tastes in beer for nearly a decade. He looks at the explosion in microbrews and the interest in imported beers. Then Stephen reports his finds on his website and his books like The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide and here on The Splendid Table. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Steve, you are our official beer guru. Now, you've got to help me with something. I see a lot of microbreweries making something called India Pale Ale. What is it?
Well, you know, people hear that name and they think, oh, India Pale Ale, it must come from India. But
right.
In actual fact, it's a British style. It's not an Indian style at all. India doesn't really have an indigenous beer culture other than what came over from England. So the origins of India Pale Ale, if you work backwards from the name, you see Pale Ale, which was a basic British style, which had a pronounced hopping rate. And by hops, I mean these are the herbs that flavor beer. They give beer bitterness, also aroma. But they were originally introduced as a preservative. So using that as a basis, the English brewers were shipping beer over to Englishmen in India.
Uh-huh.
But the problem was it was going bad because it's a long ocean voyage. They were in wooden casks and the beer was just going sour. So somebody came up with a brilliant idea of if we increase the alcohol, which is a preservative,
uh-huh.
and increase the hopping rates, another preservative, the beer will last. So that's what you get, your basic IPA. It's a slightly higher alcohol and slightly higher hopping rate than a normal pale ale.
So what does it taste like?
Well, I guess the most pronounced flavor you notice is bitterness because hops are bitter. But, you know, you should also have a balancing malt in there. And there are two basic variations on the theme. The North American IPA has a much more pronounced bitterness to it, where the English IPA will generally be a little lower in alcohol because, just generally speaking, all English ales are slightly lower in alcohol than North American ales. And also the hops won't be quite as influential in the British version.
So are there some brands we can look for?
Well, North American IPAs, there are two great ones conveniently located on either coast. Anchor Liberty Ale is from the Anchor Brewery in San Francisco, California, and that is just a brilliant IPA. And in Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Brewing Company does what they call an East India Pale Ale, or an EIPA,
mm-hmm.
Just to be a little more literal, I suppose.
Do we ever see any of the British India Pale Ales here?
Yeah, we do from time to time. A lot of people get a little miffed if they're used to North American IPAs. They try a British IPA. They think, well, you know, this doesn't really have a lot of hops to it. But, you know, it's a more malty, rounded whole. Something like Marston's Brewing makes a terrific IPA that you can find around North America.
So what do we team India Pale Ale with? What foods?
This is my favorite because this is where it gets back to some kind of symmetry with India. Because we all know about Indian curries,
right.
Hot, spicy curries. I love it. I'm a big fan of curries. And one of the best things to have with any spicy food is a hoppy beer. So if you think of hops in terms of the way you think of acidity in wine, with, you know, high spice, high salt, high oiliness,
mm-hmm.
you look for high acidity in wine. Same with beer, only you look for hoppiness. So a really hoppy beer like an EIPA goes wonderfully with a plate of good curry.
Okay. Hey, Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Steve Beaumont is author of The Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. You can find his picks of India Pale Ales on our website, splendidtable.org. Science and romance usually don't mix, except in people like Diane Ackerman. She's a naturalist and a poet, the melding of science and imagination, the kind of person who contemplates the world around us. She loves to wake up our senses. She can even have us smelling baking bread on the radio.
On a really cold day, I sometimes fill the house with the smell of baking bread, its perfume clinging to draperies and hair. Few things feel as renegade as baking in winter and steeping oneself in rich aromas one associates with a living larder, the farm fields and sunny green gardens. If you're lucky enough to spend a morning eating oven-warm bread while bathing in a tub scented with lavender oil and reading a garden book, then seizing the winter day can be a sensory glut. I enjoy the powerful aromas of plant oils, lavender being a favorite, but if I had to choose a scent vital to people of many lands and eras, bread would win hands down. Most bread is a soft, fragrant, cloud-like thing under a sturdy crust, a food both robust and voluptuous. It oozes alluring scents, powerful enough to distract one from work or play. In many languages, the word for bread is male or neuter, le pain, das Brot. But that's surprising, because women have so often been associated with the sensuality of bread and the practicalities of baking. In fact, etymologically at least, woman is bread making. In ancient days, the word for lady, chlefdige, meant kneader of bread. A woman kneads the bread of the family, shaping it, warming it, combining the ingredients of different personalities. From her doughy body, she bears them. With her stubborn hands, she forms them. In the oven of her love, she binds them together. The mother is mortar. Her task is nothing less than the creation of paradise. Her motto might be something like, live, love, and break bread. Realtors understand the intense emotions unleashed by scents, and one of their favorite gambits is to have bread baking in a house being shown to a prospective buyer, especially in winter. Wafting from the kitchen, clinging to the walls of house and mind, the aroma suggests family meals in a home where comfort reigns and all hungers may at last be met.
Diane Ackerman is a naturalist and poet, author of Cultivating Delights, A Natural History of My Garden. There's a soup recipe from northern Tuscany that's done with day-old bread. It's called marble cutter's soup, and it comes from the quarries where Carrara marble is cut. If you'd like to try it, find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to it. We've got Gail on the line. So, Gail, what do you want to talk about?
Fennel.
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 Oh, okay.
The herb that looks kind of like dill.
Uh-huh.
When my husband and I were in Paris, we kept getting fennel in lots of dishes. Like, especially in stews.
Yeah, yeah.
And soups. And so I came home, and I had had a friend that had given me some fennel. I have herbs in the garden. And so I have fennel everywhere. I had allowed a mature fennel to send off seeds in all directions.
Oh, this is great.
So I have bronze fennel, and I have green fennel.
Mm-hmm.
So I read a recipe for fennel, and I thought that I was supposed to eat the tubers, like at the bottom.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I see where. Okay, go ahead.
I dug that up after about an hour and a half of heavy work with a mattock and a shovel.
Yeah.
And my husband looked at me, and he said, "This is an old dried root. There's no way we can eat this." And so I said, "Well, maybe I got this wrong. Maybe, you know, when I'm reading another recipe, and it kind of acted like it was the stalk I was supposed to eat." So I chopped the stalk off of one of them, and it was tough also.
Mm-hmm.
So then I thought, well, I've got all these babies coming up. I'll eat a little one. So I went out with my spade again and dug a little one, and it didn't seem to have much taste.
Well, let me explain what the problem is here. Okay. There are two kinds of fennel. And one is the fennel that gives you stalks and a lot of leaves and the seed, and it's essentially an herb. You would use the seeds and the leaves as you do with other herbs. The other type also has leaves that look like they're dill, and the leaves have some aromatic quality, and it has seed. But what it has is a bulb that grows above the ground. You don't have to, you know, dig halfway to China to get whatever. And that bulb is edible. And it goes by a couple of names. I think Florence fennel is one of those names. It's also sometimes just called bulb fennel. And it's treated as a vegetable. Now, to season with the fennel, you use what you've been growing. And you can use the seeds, which are great. And you can use, you know, the fronds, the leaves. But don't try to eat it, because as you know, A, it's the stalk is pretty tasteless. B, you can cook it from now until 4th of July, and it's not going to be something you're going to want to put in your mouth.
It was not an Epicurean delight, was
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Now, depending on where you live, you may find the bulb fennel in the markets, because this is the season for it, depending on where it grows. I mean, it's associated with winter. But generally in most of the United States, it grows in the summer, but people ship it from California and that kind of thing. And it's delicious. It's a delicious vegetable. But I don't think you need to be digging up your seasoning fennel.
I don't think so. As I said, looked like that we were not going to make it with that. And I even took it to a dinner party, and we talked about it and looked at it and pushed it around on our plates.
And everybody was real polite, and fell. You know, but nobody tells you these things. And so, you know, you figure, why not? Hey, Gail, season away, though, because you've got a great seasoning.
I do have plenty of seeds.
You got it.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Gail.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia question. Here it is. How many calories do you have to burn to lose 1 pound? We'll have that depressing answer in a moment, and we'll continue taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for your calls this hour. That number is 800-537-5252. But before going back to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's food query. Now, the question was, how many calories do you have to burn or eliminate from your diet to lose 1 pound? The answer is 3,500 calories. Depressing, right? Well, remember the great secret. exercise. I found a website that tells you how many minutes you have to exercise to lose 1 pound. For instance, if you weigh 150 pounds, to lose 1 pound, you could run 12 miles per hour for 130 minutes. You could groom your horse for 518 minutes. You could play with your kids for 777 minutes. Or you could shop for 1,296 minutes. Okay, that's the news for today. And guess where you're going to find me next weekend? Let's get back to the phones. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's been waiting patiently. We've got Gwen on the line. So, Gwen, what pressing issue do you have?
The pressing issue I have is I work in a restaurant, and I've recently been offered Chinese truffles. And I didn't know that there was such a thing. And I wanted to know if they are, what their potency is and how do you use them. And are they worth, they're much less expensive than the truffles I've been offered from Italy or France or even locally.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know any, they're still pricey. And I would like to know before I commit to, I think you have to buy a half pound. Before I commit to that, I was wondering if you had any information on, you know, what their quality, potency, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. You're a chef?
Yes.
Where do you chef?
At the Aurora Restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Ah, okay, okay. I'll be honest, I've never heard of Chinese truffles. But there is no country that has the monopoly on truffles. You know, they grow wild. There are truffles in America. I mean, I'm not surprised there might be truffles from China.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the key. How much are they asking a pound for them?
I think it's $80 for a half pound.
$80 for a half? Well, yes, that is a lot cheaper than the stuff from France and Italy, but that's a lot of money if they're not good.
Yeah.
Will anybody let you see them and smell them?
I don't know. I do have a pesky salesman that comes by every now and again. So
well, you tell him I pays the money after I have a sniff.
Uh-huh.
Here's the thing. Do you know if they're black or white truffles?
Black.
Black. Okay. A good truffle is something that if it were sitting in the middle of a room that was, let's say, 20 feet by 10 feet, when you open the door to the room, you'd know it was there.
Mm-hmm.
It's that intense and that aromatic. It's not a bargain if you don't have that level of aroma, because otherwise a black truffle, even a white truffle, is sort of like rubbery, expensive, you know, nothing.
Fungus.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say that you want to take a sniff of these things.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem with fresh truffles is they lose moisture very quickly,
mm-hmm.
unless somebody's sealed them, you know, or done something that keeps them from losing that moisture. And then they have the other problem of they can develop mold.
Ah.
So they really should be used in the best of all possible worlds within a week of after being dug.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd raise an eyebrow about this. I'd insist on smelling them before buying them. And once you buy them, I would figure either freeze them
mm-hmm.
or plan on using them really quickly. And the best way to keep them is seal them in something like a Ziploc bag and put them in the fridge.
Okay, and when I freeze them, when I just do the same thing, put them in the Ziploc?
Yeah, essentially, yes.
Okay, because I'd had people bring them to me stored in rice.
You don't want to never buy them that way, because what happens is the rice literally pulls the moisture out of them. Yeah, exactly. It's an old way of doing it, but the real people used to put it in pasta, put it in rice. Now, one thing you can do is do that just for a couple of hours to give the rice flavor.
Mm-hmm.
The other great trick is you bury the truffle in a bowl full of unshelled raw eggs in the fridge
mm-hmm.
for overnight at most, and then you pull it out, and the eggs are going to taste like truffles.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, but that's only if you get that really intense aromatic truffle. Okay?
A really good one.
Gee,
Chinese. I have another question.
Sure.
What do you think of edamame soybeans being substituted for fava beans?
I think it's a great idea.
I recently have seen those in the grocery.
The problem, you know, with fava beans is for a lot of people, they can only get them in the spring.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're not in good shape. And edamame has even more protein. It tastes different. It's sweeter than fava.
Mm-hmm.
But often they're in better shape than most fava beans are.
Yeah, they talk about edamame being grown in North Carolina to take over some of the cash crop that was lost by tobacco, saying that there that they could be a cash crop for this area. So
I would say try it and see what you think. But to me, it would change the dish slightly, but you'd still have that lovely. The beans have a similar quality in the mouth. They're really good. They have a lot of flavor, both fava and edamame. Edamame has more protein.
Yeah, I've never really come in contact with a fresh fava that looked like it was in good enough shape to buy.
And that's the problem. I mean, if you can, and they're easy to grow, but just there isn't a big market for them. I'd say try it and let us know what you think.
Okay.
And maybe give us a call and tell us about the Chinese truffles if you end up trying one.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to try to get my salesman to bring me one.
Great.
Thank you so much for your help.
Hey, you're welcome. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us 800-537-5252. We have, let's see, Diane is on the line. So, Diane, what's on your mind?
I have a question about salted and unsalted butter.
Uh-huh.
Usually at home I just have salted butter, and I have some recipes that call for unsalted butter, but then later in the recipe they'll also ask you to add salt.
Right.
So what I want to know is how much salt is in a stick of butter?
That's a great question. And you know what? There's no set answer. There must be a regulation somewhere that says you can't put more than X amount of salt in a pound of butter. But the reality is that it varies from one processor to another. I've had sticks of butter with salt in them that are so salty, you know, it tastes like popcorn that somebody's gone too far with. And this is one of the reasons why most cooks call for in their recipes unsalted butter, because you have much more control. And the other thing is that, do you know the reason why butter is salted, at least originally?
Why? To preserve it.
That's right. And if the butter is going off in any way, the salt will cover that up. And generally, you want to know if your butter's going off. So you buy unsalted butter, and if it tastes cheesy or it has any kind of off aroma or taste, you know you don't want it, whereas the salt might cover that up.
Okay, well, I was hoping it'd be an easy answer, like you could tell me something like a quarter teaspoon.
No, because it does vary according to which, and I would say, I mean, generally you could say the cheaper the butter, the more salt there may be in it, but I don't even know if that's true. I just know that in buying a lot of different brands of butter, I'm a butter taster.
So you think I should switch to unsalted?
When you're cooking, yeah. But if you like the taste of salted butter, for goodness sakes, keep it for eating. But when you're cooking, just to give you more control, go for some unsalted. Stick it in the freezer. It keeps beautifully.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. It's a really good question, this idea of salted versus unsalted butter. Old recipes, back in the days when people made their own butter, would call for salt and sometimes also call for saltpeter, which is a preservative. You know this business about how adulterated our food is and how we all yearn for the golden olden days? Let me tell you, the golden olden days were a nightmare. The amount of additives that were put in everyday foods, and you couldn't tell if it was there, things like dirt in ground pepper, chemicals in milk to stretch it, and things like all kinds of preservatives in butter that you really don't want in your body. So the golden olden days weren't all that golden. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we've got Bruce calling. So, Bruce, tell me, what do you want to talk about?
My family enjoys smoked salmon a lot, and I'm always looking for new sauces. So I thought I'd ask you for some ideas on some sauces and share a wonderful sauce that I found for smoked salmon.
Well, why don't you tell me yours first, then I'll tell you mine.
Okay. One is strawberry preserves and fresh lemon juice. Take your strawberry preserves, about a quarter cup, and put it in a saucepan or a skillet, and gently heat it, and add maybe another quarter cup or so of water, a little cornstarch, and thicken it, and then the juice of one lemon and a little bit of lemon zest, and that is wonderful on smoked salmon.
Really? I would imagine it would be almost too sweet for the salmon, but, that's great.
The lemon juice cuts the sweetness a bit.
Yeah, I see what you mean. By the way, where are you from?
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Ah. Now, which kind of smoked salmon are you using? Are you using the kind that's hot smoked, in so many words, it's really cooked through, or the kind that's very, very moist?
It's fairly moist. I have a electric smoker. Use a water pan, smoke it about an hour and a half.
So you're doing your own.
Right.
Oh, that's the best. Well, there's a couple of other, you're onto something there, because generally, because of the intenseness of the smoke and the fattiness of the salmon, often what works great with smoked salmon is something acidic. I mean, When you order great smoked salmon in a lot of fancy restaurants, you know what it comes with? It comes with a little pile of diced onion and a few lemon wedges. Mm-hmm. And the idea of just that lemon juice over that rich salmon that has all that smoke, absolutely dynamite. Mm-hmm. Simple, you know, you taste the purity of the smoked salmon. Another trick is, and this is one that we borrowed from roast beef. You know, have you ever heard of horseradish sauce for roast beef? You whip cream, you grate some fresh horseradish, you fold the horseradish, salt and pepper to taste, into the whipped cream, and you just have a little dab of that with the smoked salmon.
Mmm, sounds good.
Killer. Just killer. The other thing is a sour cream mustard sauce with a ton of fresh dill. Just take sour cream, lemon juice to taste, some real strong coarse grain mustard, you know, mm-hmm. and then a ton of fresh dill. Fold that all together. And again, you don't need a lot of that. You need like a tablespoon
mm-hmm.
on the plate. Wonderful. And you kind of dip the salmon in that. So see what you think.
Sounds wonderful.
Okay, and keep smoking that salmon.
Oh, well, we will. Thank you.
You take care, Bruce.
Bye.
Smoked salmon. We're finding it's turning into almost a bargain fish, especially in the winter. Lots of people have sales on it. And the best smoked salmon has the least amount of ingredients on the label. Ideally, salt, maybe sugar, and that's it. Try it. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Hank on the line. So, Hank, what's up?
Well, some time ago, my wife and I were preparing garbanzos, and we sauteed onion, garlic, green pepper, and used that along with some vegetable stock.
Mm-hmm.
And we put in a product, I think that's from Mexico.
Yeah.
It's called Sazon Goya.
Oh, Goya is a G-O-Y-A?
Oh, yeah.
I think Goya is a Spanish or Caribbean processor, you know, canner and whatever. Yeah.
Right.
And I guess it means seasoning. Right?
Yeah, I deduced that. But anyway.
By the way, this is showing you my incredible linguistic abilities.
I'm kind of showing off too, you know. But anyhow, and everything was going fine. The garbanzos, by the way, were pre-cooked. I mean, they were out of the can.
So you mixed garbanzos into there.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And I think we added some potatoes.
Okay.
And we put it on and simmered it, turned it off, covered it. The next day we uncovered it, and heavens, it had fermented.
What did it look like?
It looked a little foamy. You know, it had the kind of the odor of old beer. And
mm-hmm.
So anyway, we'd like to ask you what was going on.
Oh, you know, one of the ways you learn a lot of stuff is by making many mistakes.
Yeah, we've done that.
Yeah, right. Hank, I've done exactly what you did. You know, cooked beans in some way and left them out overnight. What's happened is you really did have fermentation, that the starch in the beans essentially, evidently, actually starts fermenting, and it's just warm enough to encourage that.
Maybe.
Now, maybe the seasonings had something to do with it, but I tend to think not. I mean, sometimes we're lucky, you leave them out, nothing happens. Sometimes it's just warm enough. You know,
yeah.
The moon's in the right place.
Yeah, things are right.
Yeah, exactly. It's usually a good idea with bean stuff is once they're cooked, try to chill them down as fast as possible and put them, you know, in the fridge or someplace cold.
Yeah.
Depending on where you live, it might be the back porch.
Okay.
But it's a good idea because, boy, do those things love to ferment.
Yes.
But, hey, thanks for a great question.
Okay.
You're going to save all
Enjoy
of us from...
Enjoy talking to you.
Good talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Things that start bubbling in the night and you don't do anything to make them happen, just a very good idea. Anything that you cook, get it cool down fast and get it cold. Not warm, not room temp, but cold. It's kind of an insurance policy that nothing nasty is going to happen. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up? Phyllis has been waiting patiently. Phyllis, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about pomegranates.
Oh, they're wonderful.
Well, they are if you know what to do with them.
I'm sorry, but I'm picturing, yeah, when you first try to eat a pomegranate, you get so frustrated you want to throw it on the floor and jump up and down on it.
It's like, how do you eat this stuff? You know, the center of it, which is got like a gelatin in it,
yeah,
is so good, but it's mixed with so many seeds.
And you want to know how to separate that gel sort of stuff from the seeds?
Yeah, I do. How do I prepare it or just eat it fresh?
I've got good news and I've got bad news. Which do you want first?
Well, the bad news.
All right. The bad news is that unless you want to make juice, if you try to separate the gel from the seeds, what you end up with is nothing.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can put it in your mouth and suck it off.
Well, that's true. And that's what a lot of people do. But a lot of people just eat the seeds.
Oh, they're so woody.
Well, they are. But, you know, we all get a little fiber that way. But a lot of people suck on them because one of the most beautiful ways to use a pomegranate is to scatter those seeds with that clear ruby gel or fruit around them, you know, over a dish.
I see.
Like, you know, fish or a salad. We do a green bean salad with pomegranate that... You could just bring it to your knees. It's so good. But if you want to get just the juice and some of that pulp, there's a neat trick. What you do is you roll the pomegranate on a counter to soften it slightly, you know, really apply pressure and roll it, and then just put a hole in it and squeeze like crazy into a bowl.
You
will get the most delicious juice. It takes a lot of pomegranates to make a great deal of juice, but it is so good, and it's wonderful in cooking as well. But otherwise, you cut it into quarters, and you pick out those seeds. Do this over a bowl to catch any juice, and you can freeze them, by the way. They freeze beautifully and save them for when they're out of season. But as far as getting the gel off, no. It's, you know, like trying to roll a stone up Mount Everest. It isn't going to work.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Thank you so much for your help.
Goodbye, Phyllis.
Bye. Enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this. As you ramble through life, whatever be your goal, keep your eye upon the donut and not upon the hole. So silly. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. It's full of some of the things I like to have in my kitchen. You can find it right there on our homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.